Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As the days get shorter and the nights get longer, my friends at the Pleasure Chest will be diving deeper into cosplay and even more BDSM than usual. Follow at Pleasure Chest Stores on Instagram and Twitter for up-to-the-minute info on their free weekly workshops on kink technique in New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago. The Pleasure Chest will be featuring some of their favorite kinky superstars and leather gear on their site and social media all month long. They're also offering 20% off their most popular kink features from October 25th till October 31st, only at PleasureChest.com. Pleasure Chest stores are stocked with costumes and accessories for Halloween. All stores will have candy out and hidden boupons around the store with delicious discounts on October 30th and 31st. Have a safe, creepy, happy Halloween from Wire People Into That and the Pleasure Chest. And now, on with the show. It still feels like summer, which I'm thrilled about, but we are getting into autumn, and for that reason and many more, I am so glad to have Laura Westengard on my show. How's it going, Laura?
Great. I'm so excited to be here.
Laura is here because she is my friend and has lots of really interesting things to say about things that are very interesting to me, and I think probably my listeners as well, but also because she has written this new book, which is called Gothic Queer Culture, Marginalized Communities and the Ghosts of Insidious Trauma, which is not a title that you can say without a sort of Elvira voice. And Laura is an associate professor of English at the New York City College of Technology, City University of New York, aka CUNY, aka the word that my phone always wants to autocorrect cunt to. Do you get that?
It happens to me a lot.
You run the gender and sexuality studies department at...
It's a program, not a department. So
got it.
Yeah, I'm an associate professor in the English department, and that's where our gender and sexuality studies program is housed, but it is interdisciplinary. So we have classes across various departments, not just English.
Cool.
And I'm the point person for that. So I pull it together.
Hell yeah. Laura, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about this book, which, unless I'm mistaken, is your first book.
Yes, it's my first book that I have sole authored. Gothic queer culture came out of my dissertation work, actually. So when people ask me how long I've been writing it, I tell them at least 10 years.
Great. What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was called Queer Monsters Within.
Yes.
And it was a similar topic that came out of actually sitting back and reflecting on my years in graduate school and suddenly realizing at the end of the road that there was a theme amongst all of the work that I had done, all the writing I had done in my classes, and it was gothic. I was always writing about monsters and ghosts, and it was also queer. So I started to think, what is pulling these two things together in my mind? And one of my fields of specialization was trauma studies. And
cool.
So when
cool.
these three things came together.
Cool about trauma is it's cool for trauma to be studied.
And important and necessary. And, you know, in that vein, when I was writing this book, I had some, my editor, for example, said, is there any way you could make this more fun? I'm like, well, I can try, but it is trauma studies. So
yeah.
Fun is not the first word that people use when they describe me.
Maybe catharsis.
Yeah.
For actually acknowledging that trauma exists as a step towards creating a world that doesn't traumatize us. quite so much.
Yeah, catharsis, visibility, just opening up a conversation for things that are so taboo in our culture. And that is true of both queerness and trauma experiences. People, you know, paradoxically, we're not supposed to talk about trauma in public, right? That's something that's reserved for our private reflections, our therapeutic interactions.
Or just stuffing away into repression. The sewers and just not acknowledging, which is fine. It'll just stay there, I'm sure.
It'll pop back up.
Oh, no.
It will haunt you, right?
Oh, no.
So yeah, we're encouraged to maybe repress our traumatic experiences, or it's not polite conversation. But what's the paradox there is that trauma demands expression.
Yes.
And so when people have an experience that's traumatic, often even though it's escapes our ability to discuss it in a traditional narrative way, we're also driven to try to understand it through language, through storytelling, through artistic creation. What I noticed when I was looking at various instances of traumatic expression, these kinds of productions that come out of traumatic experience, is that there's often a gothic element, sort of a darkness, a use of certain gothic tropes that I talk about in the book in order to try to access this traumatic experience that is really by definition inaccessible. People often describe trauma as unspeakable, and it's not because you're not supposed to speak it necessarily, but it's actually impossible to get at the full truth of a traumatic experience for various reasons. And so many people say that that's frustrating, and people pathologize that kind of inability to discuss your own traumatic experience. But I say also, you know, the flip side of that is that it drives creativity.
Yeah.
People, when they can't narrativize an experience, they try other ways to get at that experience. And so you end up with a lot of creativity that comes out of the traumatic wound. I started writing this book to trace, like, what is that connection between gothicism and trauma? And since I also do queer studies, I started honing in on the queer cultural production that uses gothicism in order to get at trauma. And as we know, queer folks they experience trauma in life.
And
it's,
we have creativity
dangerous.
Gushing out of our trauma wounds everywhere.
Exactly. Glittery, gushing trauma. Queer folks often experience bounded traumatic events, very traditional kinds of traumas that we understand, violence in the world. But in addition to that, there are daily experiences of trauma that are built into the structures of our society that we call these days microaggressions.
And that's what you call insidious trauma.
Exactly.
Right?
In the study of trauma, historically, when the field started to be developed, people focused very exclusively on these sort of traditional bounded traumas. So, you know, natural disasters, being nearly killed in a train accident.
Or like shell shock, right?
Exactly.
From war.
War, rape, and things where people's sense of safety and ability to exist in the world feel threatened. But that doesn't really get at the microaggressive traumas, the daily traumas that we all experience. And that hasn't really been studied that much in trauma studies, only more recently.
Often those bigger traumas are dismissed, or we're asked to stuff them away or not speak about them. But the thing that makes microaggression every day, death by a thousand cuts, trauma, what makes it insidious is also that constant dismissal. And then we start to self-police.
Exactly.
Right? And think, I'm the problem. I'm making too big a deal out of this. I'm too sensitive. I need a thicker skin. This is normal and natural, and I should just get over it.
Right. And
like a migraine.
I mean, it is quote unquote normal, right? If we think about
it's commonplace.
Exactly. If we think about normal as something that is just the norm, it is the norm for people with marginalized identities in whatever way they intersect that creates their experience in the world, to have small instances of like a sense of marginalization or
dehumanization
or, you know, devaluing their, you know, input in culture or their ability to exist in the world. These are things that are, you know, disgustingly normal.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. Insidious trauma is compounded by the fact that it's not recognized as trauma. So not only is it something where you feel it, you notice it, it accumulates in your experience, your daily experience in the world, but also when you try to voice it, the reaction of people around you is, stop being so sensitive. Can't you take a joke? Right? This is just the way things are.
Yeah.
And to not have your trauma recognized is another kind of trauma that is layered on top of the original experience.
I don't know. It feels like there's another layer of trauma, not to mention a burden of emotional labor of trying to be the Cassandra in the coal mine, like screaming that this is bad for me, this is bad for us. Sometimes when it's bad for marginalized people, it's about to be bad for everybody else, and we're like trying to warn people, or at least be like, fucking, like, listen to us when we say that this is bad. When we don't have the support that we need, we express it in all kinds of ways, like addiction or or perpetuating cycles of abuse, right? Maybe even like horizontal violence also, where we're like taking out this trauma on one another instead of paying attention to the people who are maintaining the circumstances that allow this trauma to perpetuate.
Yeah.
Those people don't experience any consequences. And meanwhile, we're all like yelling at each other and taking it out on each other. And that is by design. That's how trauma keeps itself alive.
Right, by internalizing the structures that have traumatized you in the first place and then policing others
exactly.
by those rules.
Or you get a little bit, you have a little bit of privilege in one way, and then you throw other people, more marginalized people, under the bus in order to make yourself feel safe. This is something I try to write about a lot.
And this, even that is a survival strategy.
Yeah.
In a culture where, you know, we're consistently told that we don't have access to power or we don't deserve access to power. So if you internalize the structures of power and then are able to sort of get one step up within that structure, a lot of people will take that as a way to survive in the world.
Yeah, I would argue that in the long run, it doesn't make them any safer.
Absolutely not.
Because you're just creating more dangerous circumstances for more people, and then also other people are gonna fucking step on you on their way to the top.
Yeah. So that's one of the main goals of my book, to displace the focus from interpersonal, like individual interactions, to look at how the structures of oppression, the institutional practices, are the primary perpetuators of insidious trauma, that we're all functioning kind of within this structure that is built to be oppressive to certain folks. And we need to pay attention to that large scale issue and not blame each other one-on-one necessarily. Like, we can call each other in and make sure that we're all sort of paying attention, but our critical thinking needs to extend beyond the individual level, because that really is like a neoliberal narrative, right?
Oh, yes.
It's asking the individual to be responsible for changing the world when the structures, the powers that be, have built the world to exist the way that it is with this hierarchical structure. And that's always going to be a failing enterprise, but it does occupy us, right? It occupies our attention trying to like just be brave or, you know.
Yeah, be empowered. Yeah. Buy this thing that will empower you.
Right.
Yeah. Laura, this is all extremely my shit. And I'm so glad that you're studying it in the particular way that you do. And, you know, I am a total theory head. I love theory books. I especially, my favorite kind of theory books will sort of take
highbrow or intellectual theory or modes of analysis and use them on something that is maybe considered lowbrow or lower brow, your book completely exemplifies that, where you take genre fiction of all kinds, mostly horror, some movies, some TV shows, definitely a lot of performance art, contemporary queer performance art, which mm-hmm. was really exciting to read about people who I see all around me making this work, and to see your analysis of them and contextualizing this with a lot of more ancient texts as well. I'm probably biased because you're my friend and because I love just digging into all of this, like, heady theory stuff, but I think that this book is really accessible to a wider audience. I think that if anybody is interested in queerness or horror or trauma or just thinking about queer art, especially the dark side of queer art and cultural production, I think that they would love this book. So they should buy it. They should buy your book. What's the best place for people to buy it?
So it is on Amazon if we want to go that route. It is also on the publisher's website, which is University of Nebraska Press.
Cool.
And I can also share a code for 40% off.
Oh my God. So many percents. It's such a high percent.
It's a high percent. And it should be in bookstores. I have a book release event coming up at Blue Stockings.
Hell yeah. I feel like a lot of what you're looking for is work that confronts and undermines insidious trauma, not just comments on it, but it sort of takes like a satirical approach, or even just in the sense of trying to call attention to it and make people uncomfortable.
Yes.
And you make a really interesting case for True Blood failing to do that for a lot of different reasons. And I love True Blood. And as I was reading it, I was like, oh man, this is
sorry.
No. Like, all of this is true. And that doesn't mean that I won't still enjoy my trash.
I think to, you know, answer this, I may have to back up a few centuries. So
please,
let me start at the beginning. When I say gothic queer culture, what, you know, what do I mean by gothic?
I guess I could have asked you that first. I guess I just assume that people listening are like, gothic, of course. But no, it's true. Goth is not just what you shop for at Hot Topic.
Exactly. And there are a lot of ways to be gothic. And goth is a subcultural aesthetic in the way that we think about, you know, Hot Topic. Though, I mean, goths would be mad at us for saying that. But the way that I use it is that back in the 18th and 19th century, starting in England, but also extending into the United States, there was a new and exciting and controversial genre of literature. Some people wouldn't even deem it literature. It was smut in a lot of ways, that became very popular. And
what was that genre?
It was gothic fiction. And so it was a feminized genre, which is really interesting. There were women writers, there were women readers, and that was part of why it was devalued. But also, it dealt with the supernatural. Mm. It dealt with things that were irrational. It was fantastic. And it's in the course of its narrative, it indulged in structures of, like, relationship structures, family structures, and behaviors that were considered unacceptable in polite culture at the time. So people would read it almost like someone would read a romance novel today. Sure. And maybe, like, hide it a little bit.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about the context of that time and the idea of something like queer desire or chosen family. It might as well have been supernatural.
Right. And the only way they could really talk about it was through supernatural metaphors.
Right.
So there was something always vaguely queer about the content of these novels, but the structure of them was like a strange hybrid of genres and ways of writing that that people thought was monstrous. They actually called it like a monstrous aesthetic. But what's important to know is that even though people read these novels and were titillated by them, they were inherently conservative in that anything that happened throughout the course of the narrative, we might, you know, be excited by sort of incestuous narratives or different kinds of sexualized power relations. But in the end,
they always get punished.
They always get punished.
And order is always restored.
And order is restored by usually a, you know, monogamous heterosexual pairing through marriage, which is, you know, a traditional narrative arc. Like that happens in, even in like sitcoms often.
And right? fairy tales.
And fairy tales. Yeah. Yeah. And, but what is the purpose of fairy tales, for example, is to
morality.
Teach a lesson. Yeah. Yeah. And so the point of...
Maybe also the point of sitcoms could be argued.
Sure. I mean, think about mid-century sitcoms like Leave It to Beaver or The Brady Bunch. There was always a lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, no, I'm just thinking about the lessons that people were learning in the 90s from Friends, but I can't even go there.
That's for another
truly
podcast.
Horrific. Okay, but go on, go on.
There was this idea that you could fetishize the supernatural and the queerness of the gothic content in those novels, but because that was so scary and disruptive, it was simultaneously titillating but also uncomfortable.
Right.
So that made the restoration of order even more desirable.
Oh man.
And so it was teaching people that you could fetishize the content, but then it always had to be sort of fixed in the end, and that was the right way to be, is the normative that was restored by the end of the story.
It's interesting to think about the concept of cultural appropriation and how it sort of follows that narrative, where people who maybe have like conventional tastes want, like, I'm thinking specifically about the cultural appropriation of sexual subcultures, where people want to like wear a leather harness as part of like quote-unquote post fetish fashion, but they want like just enough of the glitter, just enough of the grit to give them a thrill, but then there always has to be some context of restoring the norm.
Right. And that has a lot to do with risk, right? Who people aren't willing to adopt an identity or, you know, a cultural mode to the extent that it's going to make them sacrifice their safety in the world, or right?
Yeah.
And so that ties back into the trauma of the folks who, you know, don't have another choice. That's an authentic expression of, you know, who they are, how they want to be in the world. And with that comes vulnerability and risk and, you know, insidious trauma that infiltrates your existence. But,
it's worth it to be true to yourself. Right. But that's also part of the reason that queer people or people who are part of, say, leather subcultures get frustrated by cultural appropriation, because they, you know, it's like, we don't, this is who we are, and we're not just parachuting in and having a thrill and then returning to a point of safety and stability. We live in darkness and danger.
Yeah.
And we're like, you know, we've like settled in and like gotten comfy in it, but that doesn't mean that it is that... that destabilization does not affect us.
Exactly. People say the first gothic novel was Horace Walpole's The Castle of Otranto, which was 1764. So
which
that's
is super
kind of
incesty.
Yeah, for
right.
sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I look at in the book is the way that the metaphors that were established in the 18th and 19th century filter into the way that queer cultural producers, queer artists and writers deal with queerness, talk about queerness within structures of oppression, whether that's drawing attention to the traumas, drawing attention to the problematic structures, or just, you know, indulging in the darkness. And that, I would say, is a, you know, the subversive aspect of gothic queer culture. It's when queer folks have taken this thing that was originally used against them to police and contain any non-normative gender or sexuality, and saying, you know, like the term queer itself, like, fuck you. Yeah, I am a monster.
Yeah, what could be queerer than what you are describing? Taking that and transforming it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's a reappropriation of something that was, you know, used to make money, really, off of the policing of queer folks, which in itself is an insidious trauma.
Of course.
Right. But that doesn't mean that queer folks haven't used those kinds of exposures, right, and taken them for themselves. So if we think about, I don't know, are you familiar with The Celluloid Closet,
Vito
Russo?
Yeah.
Talking about how, okay, so over the course of 20th century cinema, queer folks have appeared in one way or another, but usually they're considered the sick sociopath or the murderer
or the clown.
So starting with the queer as like the funny person that we laugh at, then the queer as like a monstrous predator,
and like then, Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs,
right? Or Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca.
Yes,
these depictions of queerness across the decades have been damaging.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that queer folks haven't gravitated towards them and taken that as some grasping at visibility.
Right.
And,
yeah, we love Mrs. Danvers.
Yeah, I love Mrs. Danvers. I think I told you that Mrs. Danvers is like an like a root for me.
I ran into you on the bus and was like, oh, I just went to see Rebecca. And you just like fucking swooned. Like you were clutching your mistress's lingerie to your breast.
I identify with Mrs. Danvers mostly. Yeah. I'm the creepy person in the high Victorian collar walking around quietly with like extended staring eye contact, and I will burn for my love.
Yeah, of course.
You know, my exploration of Gothic queer culture is that sort of reparative, redemptive use of reappropriating something that was originally designed to police queerness. And when I get to talking about True Blood, I'm seeing that, you know, the reappropriation of queerness that queer folks have used in, you know, through ever since it was created. I mean, it's queer folks have always existed and have always sort of like looked for representation that they can take for themselves and use to sort of support their existence and survive.
So like, for example, an example of something that you mentioned a second ago of the kinds of monster metaphors that were established in early Gothic literature. So like, I took a Gothic literature class in college, and we talked about, that was sort of the first place that the concept of the vampire as other was introduced to me. And we talked about a lot of different otherness in that class. We talked about the other as just straight up like Eastern European, right? I mean, which is what, you know, Dracula and Transylvania and ethnic other, which
anxieties
is
anxieties around migration and
exactly
specifically Jewish migration. Well,
you
from
took
Eastern Europe.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Right, that was the thing that blew my mind the most as a Jew, that vampires were about anxieties about Jews that you like, they look just like everybody else. But I mean, I guess I knew about the idea of Jews having like horns and tails and that kind of thing, or the Jew as monstrous. But the idea of like anti-Semitic fear being part of the construction of the vampire was really interesting to me, especially then when you put it next to like dandyism or gender transgression, which is definitely also something that you see in a lot of depictions of vampires from Dracula on. I mean, I'm sure there's earlier ones. Then, of course, the other major one, which you talk about a lot in this book, is the idea of vampires as vectors of disease.
Right.
And the way that that has played out in terms of queerness and disease in the late 20th century is...
Right, in the context of the AIDS crisis.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And also, I would add that vampires have alternate modes of penetration. That's what makes them particularly queer, is that their penetrative acts cross gender boundaries.
Oh, yeah.
They, you know, create their own holes. They don't even work with the holes that they're given. So they're really transgressive and queer.
They're interested in fluids you're not supposed to be interested in.
Yeah. And one thing that I point out is like this amazing scene in Bram Stoker's Dracula where Dracula gets into Mina's room. Mina is this, you know, paragon of British, modern British womanhood.
Right.
And he gets into her room and her fiance comes in and discovers them in an act. And they're kneeling on the bed. And Dracula has penetrated himself. He's created a hole in his own breast. And then he's forcing Mina to suck from his chest, from the hole that he's created in his chest. Her head is being held to his chest, and there's fluids dripping down her nightgown.
So it's and that is also super incest. And I'm trying to think of a word other than it's also super incest. Well, it's non-consensual, although there's also the element of seduction and glamoring. Mm-hmm. Glamour is a verb and succumbing. But it's also incesty because, like, you know, she's like feeding at his breast.
Right.
And it's like gender transgressive incest. Because that's also like vampire lineage is chosen family and like a created kinship. You know, in True Blood they say my maker, and they say like that you like sired another vampire, right? So it's also like a strange form of breeding.
Yes, which, you know, I do talk about bareback culture in the book.
Oh, that's yes. Maybe we can get to that. Yeah. Yeah, and even bug chasing and lots of that is maybe the darkest part of the book, actually. That stuff is really dark. The like literal death fetish.
Right. Yeah. Which is its own form of queer kinship.
Yeah, a really dark form of queer kinship.
Yeah. So what?
But anyway,
like, to return to, you know, Dracula and Mina, it's that when they do their fluid exchange,
so intimate.
It's so intimate.
Really, a sign of trust.
And they're bonding. They're fluid bonding.
Yeah,
and and what that gives them is access to each other's thoughts.
Yeah.
So how intimate can you get, right? You get into each other's minds by this fluid exchange. And that really speaks to something else that's queer about vampires and monsters often, especially if we look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein's monster. The creature in that novel is, like, as an archetypical monster, is this hybridity of monsters that they not only disrupt or transgress gender and sexuality, but even the notion of self and other.
Right.
They transgress the boundaries of humanity because they're monsters, but also Frankenstein's creature is created by many different people, genders, races, even animals and humans all sewn together in this one form. And Dracula is, you know, he's more discreet as an individual, but he survives by ingesting the blood of others. So in that sort of cannibalistic mode, you become what you eat, right? You are what you eat. And so monsters are, you know, they exceed even the boundaries of self and other when he and Mina are able to see into each other's minds. Where does Dracula end and Mina begin?
I feel like I have a sense of what is queer about that, not to mention kinky, and we will get into more explicit conversations about how BDSM cultures weave into all of this. But what's queer about sharing fluids and knowing each other's minds? I mean, that's just straight up romantic. And I think of that as queer romance, but I'm queer. So, technically you could have a fluid exchange that creates a deep bond that is straight, I guess. But, like, what is queer about that particular moment from Bram Stoker's Dracula to you?
I think in that particular moment, like you pointed out, there's the breastfeeding tableau.
Yes.
But I think that when you're having a romantic or erotic exchange with a monster, and a monster is inherently transgressing the boundaries of gender, race, humanity, self and other, what is that orientation, right?
Monster sexual.
Yeah, who are you fluid bonding with, right? Like, is it is it really heterosexual? I mean, maybe for readers on the surface they're seeing Mina and Dracula as a heterosexual pairing, but if we dig deeper, the nature of monsters means that they can't be located, they can't be pinned down, they slip out of our grasp when we try to frame them with our traditional understanding, which is primarily binary, of gender and sexuality. And so they're queering humanity.
So both monsters and queers are slippery, is what you're saying?
Yes, in the right circumstances.
Cool. Cool, man.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I know I've talked about this on the podcast before, but a very powerful sexual root for me was a scene in the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula movie, which is trash. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Mina scenes are great. Shout out to Winona Ryder. The sort of progression of the story, both in the book and in the movie, is first Dracula comes for her friend,
Lucy.
Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mina is sort of, as you say, like a paragon of like modern English womanhood, and Lucy is like a little bit more. What I remember about her is that she has all these suitors, and she's like the object of heteronormative desire, and she's like wealthy and super pretty, and just and a little bit of like a bimbo.
Well, so I can speak to the novel more than the movie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in many years. Both of those female characters in the book are lessons, right?
Okay.
So this is a kind of conservative gothic mode where they're teaching women how to be.
Right.
For Mina, she has the promise of being a very appropriate British woman. Her modernity, her use of technology.
Oh, I see.
Is a risk factor.
Okay.
And that's the thing that gets her in trouble. Like,
okay,
she gets herself into the situation when she should be, you know, at home, not being involved. But that's what puts her at risk with Dracula.
Yeah.
And Lucy is a little bit slutty, right?
Totally.
So she definitely has all of these heterosexual love interests. She could get settled down and get married, but she's a little wild, and
she's toying with all of these different men.
Yeah. And so she's the first to get taken down in that book.
Right, man. That's like the slasher movie idea as well, that like the slut goes first.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the movie where Lucy, the slut, it's a stormy night, and she is increasingly under the mind control of Dracula, who has, like, had his eye on her for a while and I think has been, like, staring into her window and, like, coming to visit her at night when she's asleep. Mm-hmm. And so this stormy night, she's, like, walking barefoot through the garden because he's calling to her. And Mina is like, Lucy, what are you doing? And is, like, kind of chasing her through the garden. Sort of like the scene that you were describing of Jonathan Harker coming across Mina and Dracula in an unnatural act of blood nursing. Mina comes across Lucy being like ravaged on like a stone bench by Dracula, who is in this like grotesque wolf aspect. And she's just like fucking loving it. And they're just like running like animals. And Mina's horrified. And I think that Dracula like sees Mina witnessing him fucking Lucy. There was something that Lucy being susceptible to Dracula because of being slutty, and having that desire, because like Mina kind of fights it more, right? But Lucy's like, what's happening to me? And then she succumbs to him and then is just like loving being fucked by this grotesque creature. And I really liked that. And so it's interesting to think about like moments like that that I loved as queer, but like the other really major libido moment for me as a teenager was Spike from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I've always like sort of struggled with, like, why do I feel like these technically cishet couplings, stories, dramas feel so central to my sexuality in a way that feels very queer to me? But you just kind of explained it, which is that
I'm here to validate those childhood experiences.
Thank you. That they weren't men, they were monsters.
Exactly.
So it was more about like wanting to like desire that monstrous, but and also like that sort of queer thing of like both wanting to like do it and be it. That I wanted to both like desire the monster, be desired by the monster, but also be the monster.
Yeah. And your viewership of that scene with Lucy and Dracula is like the perfect example of queer audiences watching something that's really designed to teach you a lesson.
Ah, yes.
And saying, oh, no, that's actually sexy. I think I'm going to take that and use it for my own development as a queer person. And like, you can try to teach me a lesson, but okay, I'm still going to watch this and get off on it.
That's interesting too, when you think about the sort of legacy of Spike as like the ultimate bad boyfriend from Buffy. And Joss Whedon has talked about how like, he's a little upset when people find Spike sexy, because the whole point of Spike was to comment on an abusive boy. And he's, you know, like Spike is totally abusive sometimes in ways that are not very metaphorical, that are that are very literal or not subtextual in the story. But yeah, in the sense of being like, oh, you're trying to teach me a lesson. Well, I'm just going to go ahead and eroticize that. And, you know, and then maybe like put another layer of text on it and make it make it a scene, like make it a consensual non-consent scene as opposed to a lesson about what kinds of men it's appropriate to desire, or what kinds of people it's appropriate to desire. Anyway.
And I will say, in addition to the queerness of the pairing, like having sex with a monster, it's queering behavior, right? It's like too queer as a verb.
Yeah.
Either way, it's as a queer viewer, you're seeing these multiple layers of queerness, that it's like Lucy is into it.
Yeah.
And
is that queer? Is being into sex queer, Laura?
Well, with a monster?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's just like,
she's breaking the rules of propriety.
Yeah, well, she's just being a really great bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. Thanks for psychoanalyzing me.
Anytime.
Okay. Dracula, Jews, vectors of diseases. So in what way does True Blood fail this test that you've sort of set up for queerness? So True Blood, in True Blood, the subtext of vampires as queers is made almost like achingly literal. I mean, it's not quite literal. It's still a supernatural allegory, but it's like quite on the surface with Fang bangers and God hates fangs, and the idea of like vampires as having these like clubs, their own private clubs that normal people want to visit for a little bit of a thrill.
Yeah.
And then like the fight for vampire rights, vampires coming out of the coffin, all that stuff.
So that,
which is like delightful, but also maybe what do you think? Like, pushes it a little bit too far?
I think what True Blood does is like take the allegory to another level.
Mm-hmm.
So where in the past monsters allegorically have stood for transgressive gender and sexuality, now that transgression in terms of sexuality, at least specifically, is explicit. It's overt. They, like you were describing, they are fetishized, they're sexy, they're hypersexual. By taking it to that level, it allows the allegory to be less about the sexuality. The sexuality is a given. The allegory is about assimilation. Mm-hmm. So it's about the political aspect, the vampire rights element.
Right.
And so then the vampire is wanting to come out of the coffin and integrate into society and get equal rights becomes an allegory for the marriage equality movement.
Totally.
And
homonormativity.
And homonormativity, right? So there are, interestingly and more strongly at the beginning of the series, two kinds of vampires. There's the good vampires that want to assimilate, that want to just abide by human rules. They just want to come out of the coffin, drink their fake blood, not feed on humans, not... This is all associated with, like, bourgeois normativity. It's
totally.
Like, I'm going to buy property.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to work in a job. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be a proper consumer by purchasing the correct mode of, ingesting blood.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be transgressive in that hypersexual way. So there are those... what I call assimilationist vampires.
Yeah.
And then there's the quote unquote bad ones. They're framed as the vampires that are doing damage to the vampire rights cause.
Uh-huh.
They live in nests.
Totally.
Right. So it's more than two. It's non-monogamous. They live in these sort of nests that have their queer kinship structures.
Yeah. There's definitely vampires of multiple genders.
Yeah. They are often more nomadic.
Uh-huh.
They're not as invested in norms of consumer culture. They don't hide their hypersexuality or their non-normative sexual behaviors. You know, I haven't talked about this, and maybe you can speak to this. This also intersects with sex work as a coding for the bad vampires, right? That they, the ones that participate in the fang-banging culture at the club are often the ones that are coded as bad. And the humans that consume them, too, are coded as disposable in certain ways.
Totally. Yeah, I feel like it's sort of... feels like more about sluttiness or like kink than sex work per se, in the sense that like a lot of those interactions don't seem to be transactional, although they are in the case of Lafayette and the Stephen Root character.
I want to think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, who is like a lonely, closeted gay vampire. He's both closeted as a vampire and closeted as gay.
Yeah. we'll have to think more on how that plays in,
But in the sense of Eric and Pam facilitating Fangoria, right, is the name of the bar, explicitly as a place for, as like a fucking meat market, right, for bad vampires to meet people who want to. But that's also interesting because bad vampires are interested in both non-consensual violence, literally being murderous predators, but they're also interested in consensual, sexualized feeding off of people.
Yeah.
Pam and Eric facilitate a space that is less like, come here and get murdered, and more, come here and find compatible people for consensual erotic vampire play.
They're
perceived to be a threat, obviously, because people are uncomfortable with humans desiring vampires, which is like an ongoing tension in the show. But presumably people are also upset about Fangoria because they assume that people are getting murdered or drained against their will, but actually people are going there because they want it. But then it's complicated, like we were even talking about with Dracula, with like, what does consent mean if you are a monster that has the power to glamour and seduce people?
To return to the transactional nature, the vampire blood, it has monetary value.
That's true. That's true.
And so vampires can either choose to exchange that in a way that's empowering to them, where they're making the choice, or they are also disempowered by human folks who tie them down with silver and steal their blood in order to sell it.
Yes.
It crosses over into like a drug allegory.
Totally.
The problem with this next level of allegory that they're working with. When you take a metaphor and you move it to the next level, like I was saying, it's the sexual transgression is a given, and so they're using it to talk about rights, like mm-hmm. a political discourse. It kind of assumes that what the previous metaphor was, the idea of transgressive sexuality,
has been solved, is
already solved. It's, like, it's not a thing. We just, okay, that's fine. So now we need to worry about civil rights or vampire rights, you know, assimilation and how to best achieve those political goals.
Yeah.
And what I write about in the book is that if we take it back down another level, they're also assuming that they can use the allegory of integration in order to make their case in this show. And that rests on the assumption that racial integration, that civil rights is complete, that
solved.
Like, solved, we don't have to worry about that, it's something we can just use as a metaphor itself,
which then complicates part of what you talk about that really stuck out to me, the way that the characters' identities intersect with their like literal identities intersect with their allegorical identities. Tara, who is by the end of the show a black vampire, the way that she's oppressed for being a vampire is an allegory, but the way that she may be treated in the fucking South for being a black woman is literal, and it makes it like murky and convoluted. Even the characters who are literally queer, like Lafayette, is that's something that is like a stable foundation that we can build an allegory on top of.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the show, it isn't, you know, two-dimensional. There are some intersectional aspects. It's not all problematic, but it does seem to be a return to the kind of conservative mode in a certain way that it is there to use the supernatural and its queer associations to achieve a social goal, to teach a lesson.
And the lesson in this case is homonormativity.
Exactly. It is, don't be a bad queer. You're ruining the cause for everyone else who just wants to integrate into the existing structures of society that are really oppressive structures.
So, like, don't live in nests with your queer chosen family. But, like, buy property and be a stable consumer. Don't be into all that weird sex stuff.
Mm-hmm. Get married and have it be a traditional type of monogamous two-person marriage that lives in a house that you achieve by working at a job to buy the property.
And yeah.
You know, it's that narrative of we're just like you. We just let us in. Let us into your existing institutions and we won't cause any trouble. And what that does is it re-marginalizes a whole other population within queerness. So to return to your earlier comment about how people police each other within marginalized communities, it creates a new kind of internal hierarchy where there are the queer folks, and some would say they're not queer in a sort of an anti-normative politicized way. The people who want to be part of the existing structures, and then there are the people who are seen as troublemakers. And this isn't a new phenomenon in activism since Stonewall, right? Since the gay rights movement emerged on the scene publicly, there's always been a division. In fact, at the Stonewall uprising, the Mattachine Society put a note on the window of Stonewall saying to our gay brothers and sisters, please be peaceful, maintain order. There's always been a kind of divide about those who want to achieve rights by integrating into the existing structures of society and those who want to
disrupt,
be more revolutionary, be anti-normative, be subversive.
Or just like unleash their trauma in the sense of we're tired of being traumatized, so we're gonna start fucking throwing bricks.
Yeah. In these cultural, popular cultural manifestations of queerness and gothicism, like True Blood, there's no simple way to characterize it. Mm-hmm. I think that through our conversation, there are problems that we can point out with the reappropriation of gothic queerness in for the purpose of capitalist, you know, pursuits. Like True Blood is there to sort of make profit.
And it is created by a white gay man.
Yeah.
Yeah, Alan Ball.
Right.
Yeah.
And it does have some, maybe some assumptions and lessons that we might think critically about. Mm. But there's also lots of other stuff going on. There's no, I don't want to oversimplify it by saying this is good, this is bad.
Totally.
Gothicism in queer culture works in a lot of ways, in a lot of complex ways. And one of the things that the Gothic offers us is a way to not have easy answers. It resists the easy answers.
Like queerness.
Yeah. And so, you know, I started this by saying that I'm interested in looking at, like, why is Gothicism and queerness and trauma, why are they, like, intersecting over and over again in the things that I study? I think that's part of the answer, right? That traumatic events resist characterization. Mm. They exceed our ability to talk about them in traditional ways. Gothicism, also the supernatural elements, they are shadowy. Mm. They're effervescent, right? Mm. They're elusive. Those are the things that are, that, like you said, slippery, that slip out of our ability to really, like, pin down. You can't you can't pin a ghost down. Mm. Queerness too. Queerness, specifically for folks who use queer in a kind of, like, a political resistant way, it's about not having a definition, but just resisting the assumptions of normativity or the compulsoriness of normativity. And so that too is just about, you know, disrupting, about deconstructing, and all of these things do that in similar ways. And so they come together to make this particularly useful mode for talking about trauma, but also not for not solving it. It's not about trying to solve or cure someone from a traumatic experience, because that in itself is a conservative mode. It's like you're imagining that there was some perfect whole individual that existed before the trauma, and then
that has now been corrupted.
Right, that has been ruined, which is the word that they use for Mina after she drinks from Dracula's breast, that she's ruined, right?
Right, or
which
I mean, that's
also corresponds to sexuality.
Exactly.
And so it's this idea that, all right, well, if we do the right thing, you can get back to this mythic state of perfection and wholeness. And that is an illusion too, because what that state stands for is a sort of universal ideal of the norm.
My God, I'm sorry to do this, but it's you're describing a MAGA hat right now.
Right, exactly.
Okay, moving on.
And so, like, what I'm interested in about inserting the Gothic into conversations about trauma is that the Gothic resists closure. Like, I'm not interested in the end of the Gothic novel where everything is solved.
Sure.
I am interested in the middle of it where everything is disrupted.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's happening, and everything's sort of, like, exceeding your ability to interpret, and, you know, making you think twice about your assumptions of even the nature of reality. That's a place where I think queer folks can rest and, like, create and have all of this amazing stuff that doesn't try to repair trauma. It doesn't try to repair anything. It doesn't try to force closure in the future. It's just this moment of nowness that is slippery, contingent. It's messy.
That's really helpful advice for writing horror and science fiction, to be honest, which is something that is on my mind these days. But I want to come back to that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.